He either has a microphone unplugged or.
Talk to me, Goose. Man, where's the chat button window? Oh, no, here it is. They changed my. I had a Skype update and it changed the window.
So, no word from Tracy?
No, I talked to her a little bit earlier today, but and she was on Twitter for a little while, but I don't know. She may have gone out to dinner with Fred or something. I don't know. Something about needing cuddles, so
dang,
I just left with that. So.
Dang people in their normal lives. What the hell?
I know. Damn it. Thaddeus is still unpacking his mic from PAX. He's like, oh, crap.
Oh, really?
No, I have no idea. I'm just making stuff up.
Oh. I think all that noise is coming from Mike, though. I think he's beating a punching bag or something.
Changing a trash bag. Why does it make for poor podcasting?
Changing the trash. He's taking Thaddeus out to the curb.
Oh, there it is.
There. Sorry. Hold on.
I thought you were doing fire sound effects again. That's what we did last episode. You know, the whole plastic crackling fire. And now we bring you the DM's round table.
That's pretty good.
That's, I like that, yeah. I always loved, I love those documentaries on like how they did the old old radio broadcasts, like back in the 20s. Because they had to come
like
with
shoes
whole,
hitting desks. Yeah.
Oh yeah, all kinds of a whole host of stuff that they, I mean, people on wet grass, I mean all kinds of weird stuff they had to come up with and
oh, yeah.
those Foley artists.
That now.
Well the, yeah, I guess they did Foley artists, yeah.
If yeah, the Foley guys, they had a, if you get the like super deluxe edition of the Lord of the Rings DVDs, they have like a 2-hour special with the Foleys and like all the weird stuff that they did to do sound effects for, you know, they found like a special tunnel in the middle of nowhere that was like the perfect audio place for them to do all this stuff. They have all this film of these two guys and it seems so low tech for Lord of the Rings, right? This,
well yeah,
you know, $1 million movie and they got these two dudes like, you know, throwing ice at a brick wall.
Yeah, exactly, banging two coconuts together, you know. Yeah. It's just
be a little bit more high tech than that.
Is Thaddeus back yet? Thaddeus, what are you doing? So anyway, how is everybody?
Okay. Oh, you can't hear us. Okay, Thaddeus just tweeted that the DMRT is recording. I'm enjoying listening to them thinking, or listening to them talk, thinking I can't hear them.
Yeah, because I'm right here. I've just been quiet this whole time.
Bastard.
Jerk. You know, I'm hosting the call. I could just kick you off the call.
Mr. I hang out with the rich and famous.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, we're not going to talk about that tonight, so.
Oh, who knows? Who's setting the agenda here, Thad? No, I'm just kidding.
I think the fans are. The fans
are the
setting,
fans setting it to that.
What are the topics?
That means Mike and my mom.
Giggity.
What are the topics? I don't know, man. What's going down with everybody?
I've got topics.
Well, Mike's always got topics. Mike's got lists.
I even have things we shouldn't talk about.
Oh, yeah. I want to hear that
when
list
you,
first.
When you,
I want
to
see how.
When you say it like that, Mike's got topics. It sounds like a disease.
Mike's got topics.
These symptoms are
a
red rash and some raised skin.
Really hurts when I pee.
Yeah,
it's like having issues, but more like maladies than anything. So.
Please send a get well card to Mike Shea at sliferish.com for
slash books.
His topics.
Right. Stop that.
Sorry.
Bad case of.
What's on the list of stuff not to talk about? That's what
there's only one item on the do not talk about list.
Really?
That would be that pain in the ass Gawker article about dating nerds.
Oh, we're not talking about that.
Yeah, no, we're not talking
that's
about
why
that.
I put it on the not to talk about list.
Yeah.
Yeah, we kind of dug ourselves a hole last time we even touched a topic that was like that. So.
Yep.
Not useful.
Nope.
So I've been prepping for a Hollow Earth expedition game. So oh, cool. It's been really nice. Fun.
Is that like Hollow World? Wasn't that like a published campaign setting at one point?
No, a Hollow World was the internal world to the Mystara setting in basic D&D. But this is an entirely different game. It uses the Ubiquity system.
Ah, okay.
So it's by Exile Game Studios. It's like a pulp. It's like you could do a really good Indiana Jones, you know, Nazis riding dinosaurs in the Lost World kind of RPG with it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So let's talk about this not dating nerds on Gawker issue.
No, let's not.
I wanted to get a chuckle out of Mike. I knew that would work.
Done. All done chuckling? Is that what it's like? Yep. No more chuckling. Serious face.
My chuckle.
Yeah. That was Mike the whole time at that hangout party the other week. It was like
it's just chuckling.
Mike
yeah.
In the serious
just like
face.
Like what are these guys doing? What?
I know it.
Well, were you like drinking or something?
The
what
one
was...
sober guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Google Hangout.
I was fairly sober.
Oh, you were the sober one, and you were the one chuckling? Wait, something's wrong.
I don't know if I
no,
guess
he
I
had serious old. Face. He was serious face the whole
yeah.
time.
I was writing.
Oh, he
actually,
was serious.
You can see the article I was writing at the time that just got posted.
Oh, cool, okay.
Yeah.
Posted where?
Slyflourish.com.
On Jezebel. It was about dating magic players.
Oh, wow. Boom. Maybe too soon. A little too soon, Sam. But don't post this up until like for a month. Okay? Then I'll be like, all right. Like,
oh, please, okay, cool. Whatever.
We'll put a tag in front of it that says, nah. You know, this is a sensitive topic for some, but we think it's been long enough.
Yeah, right. skip to the 4-minute mark, otherwise you're going to get really pissed.
That's right. That's always a good one.
That's what we're going for.
Yeah, that's right. Just skip this next bit. La, 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 la.
Hey, you know, if we can get as many hits on this episode of DMR as she got on her article, we would be doing okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Bunch of baiting.
They get paid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, we don't. So,
yeah, hits cost money.
Yeah.
In the podcast world. Oh, my God, I'm getting so many hits.
Yeah, that's right.
What was the band? Wasn't there a band and they came up with a crazy cover for their album? And the problem was that the album became this huge smash hit, and they lost an incredible amount of money because the album cost so much to manufacture that they were actually manufacturing at a loss. Does anybody know what that was?
It had
a holographic cover, and it was like back in the 70s. And
no, I don't remember.
It would have been a much better story if I knew the band was. But.
Yeah. I thought you were gonna bring because there was also one where it was sort of a homegrown band and they released this album and they used some art for the cover that was unauthorized. They didn't get permission and then they became really popular and then all of a sudden it was like you didn't get permission to use this art, so we're gonna sue you, and they basically lost all their royalties because they got sued. Yeah,
maybe they didn't. Yeah. Maybe
who was this?
I don't remember who it was either. So yeah, like Mike, I would tell a better story if I knew the actual details.
I know that happened to Dynamite Hack because they did like Boys in the Hood or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or what was that song? Anyway, that happened to a lot of bands. Use stuff without permission, sell a lot of CDs, then get sued for all the money.
Yeah, no, but that's like sampling tracks. I'm just talking about like the cover art. This was just the cover art thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, Dynamite Hack didn't sample stuff. They just completely redid the song without permission.
Oh, so it was like a cover, but then they released it without. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, it was.
That's an oopsie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's a topic we hit on this today. Newbie brought this up. Of course, he's really enjoyed the Mike Merle's series of articles, you know, and they've been pretty good. They've been really interesting insights, and we once again are talking about the balance between. The mathematical side, the hardcore side of D&D, you know, the math, the terrain, the miniatures, the rules, if you will, hard-coded rules, and the fluffier side, you know, storytelling and you know, ad-lib decision-making and things like that, and that is kind of on a continuum. And how do you strike that balance? And I think it's a question that we still are struggling to answer. I think a lot of us. I think a real good DM knows how to do it sort of instinctually. But I don't know if there's any real guidelines that easy.
I'll tell you why there's not real guidelines. Because every group is different. Because every group has their own preferences, and each individual player has their preferences. And when they play with a group, those preferences have to overlap to a certain extent so that everybody is at least happy enough to keep the game going. And that's different from any other group, you know?
And I think you're right, and that was mentioned too.
That's hard to... You can't write a hard and fast rule for that because you inevitably will hit on something that does not match some other person's preferences at all. Hey, the bus is going by Thaddeus's house.
Outstanding.
Was the number 75, gentlemen.
Right. You'll inevitably say something that completely doesn't match with someone else's idea of what makes a fun game, and they'll, you know, you'll get the nerd rage because they don't agree with you. So right. I like the articles too, and I find it really interesting because there is always this certain percentage of people that complain that, you know, he's not being real specific about stuff. He just sort of brings up older editions and says, well, here's how we used to do it, and now here's how we are doing it, and here's some things to consider. And then he sort of stays away from making a hard and fast rule or ruling about it. And some people are complaining about that. And it's like, well, he can't make a hard and fast rule. And I think he knows that, and that's why he's doing the articles that way. I like them too, actually. I think they're really good.
Well, go ahead, Dad. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say there's this outcry for more transparency in the design process. And so he starts this article that is just like, listen, these are the things we think about. You know, this is me spitballing design. Like, here's the way we used to do it. Here's the way we do it now. Is it working? Is it not working? Is there a better way to do it? And he doesn't answer that question because sometimes, you know, they can't. Yeah, buses come by a lot around here. We've learned that over the last year, guys.
When you live at the shelter, that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
They're really cool about letting me use their internet, though, so. No, I mean, you've got all these people wanting you to have more transparency in your design, and so you start doing that, and then people are just like, they get pissed. They're like, oh, well, you're not telling us exactly what you're doing. Well, you know, they're not making a decision right now. They may be designing 5e, they may not, but all this stuff is just him spitballing ideas, you know, trying to come up with a better game. And let's, you know, this all of this negativity is just, it's so destructive to the process because soon they're not going to want to have him publish that stuff anymore because people are starting to be jerks about it, you know? I was at the Ask a DM panel, and it was, you know, Mike Merles and Chris Perkins and a bunch of guys at PAX were on this panel, and it was for people to ask questions about how to DM, like how to fix things in their game. And so, like, more than half the questions were people coming up going, why did you design the game this way? You know, I don't understand why you made these choices. And it's just like, you know, this is not the time and place to do it. And B, shut up, you know? Just shut up.
You mean A, shut up.
Yeah. And number two, go sit down. You know, all the negativity when they're starting to finally adopt the policy of being more open is just gonna make them clam up again. You know, they're just like, look, we've decided to open these doors, and then you guys turned into a bunch of jerks, and so now we're closing them on you again.
Yeah, that's not atypical for that kind of thing, though. I mean. You know, there's a lot of rabid fans who feel like the company that's making their game is the enemy. And, you know, I've seen it when I was big into EverQuest and watching the community talk to, you know, and the EverQuest things like that were so awful because it was like one guy would walk up and complain about a rogue dagger that no one else in the room cared about. And they'd spend half an hour talking about a rogue dagger.
Right.
You know, oh, it was annoying.
Right.
One thought I had about Merle's article that I thought was pretty interesting, though, is how he talked about the attempts to try to standardize the game. You know, the idea that, you know, by putting more die rolls and more mechanics on the game, that you are building a more consistent game across groups, which can be good and bad, I guess. It's something about the RPGA that's always kind of bothered me. Which is that, you know, they want to build this kind of experience where it doesn't matter what table you're sitting at or what DM you get, that the experience you're going to get is generally the same. but it also can kind of turn into the least common denominator, where, you know, everybody's got to play the adventure by the rules the way it says, and you know, any creativity that the DM would want to throw in there is gone. And talking to my local RPGA guy, he said that it's actually something they are fighting really hard against. Like, it's something where he's like, look, he's trying to explain to the judges that, look, you have a lot more freedom than you think you have. And if the game isn't going right, or an encounter isn't going right, or the story isn't exactly what you want it, make it so. You know, alter it however you want. It's D&D. There's no points anymore. People aren't putting their characters online. You know, just run the best game that you can. And
so what you're saying is the attempt to make all the RPGA games be the same experience has actually led to them being nothing special, you know, or
yeah,
moving
very
towards the nothing special realm.
Yeah, there's two things I see, and one is where the DM kind of runs an encounter and it's kind of ho-hum, and they kind of raise their hands and say, well, that's how it's written in the book here, you know, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
And you're like, you ran the game, you know, like, you can do whatever you want, you don't have to, you're not a slave to the book. And the other one is like, ah, why don't we just call this encounter here, you know, yeah, you kind of got as far as you got, and that's fine, so why don't, and you're like, oh, really, just at the turning point, just when I was about to go kill all these guys, that's when, you know, oh, we're just gonna call it, which is the worst storytelling way to end a battle, right? Like, come up with something, some reason they fled or they gave up or whatever, come up with some reason,
yeah, or let the players narrate the slaughter of the monster if they just like, if
anything,
decide they're gonna win.
Anything,
yeah,
is better than, you know, than just saying, I think we'll just step away from the encounter at this point.
Yeah,
but anyway, I thought that was interesting that he brought that up in that article about how the mechanics are there to kind of standardize the feel of the game, which is probably more important for Wizards than it is for us, you know.
Right.
They want to make sure that the game is standard, so if people go to a D&D encounter session or they go to a Lair Assault or whatever, that it's going to, you know, D&D is going to be D&D. When we're all, you know, all the DMs want to make their game as good as possible regardless of what anybody else is doing.
Well, there's this thing called, and this happens a lot in corporations, and it's, I hate to break into marketing again, but there's a thing called messaging consistency. Mm-hmm. And, it, I work for a pet food company. So what you basically, the thing about message consistency is, regardless of where you're putting your product out at, and regardless of the kind of advertising you have or whatever, you want to be saying the same things about the product at all of those points of contact with the customer. Mm-hmm. And the same thing applies to a game company. And if they can do that by making the rules more consistent, then during various events like Gen Con and PAX, and when these kind of questions about things come up, they can answer with the same consistency over and over and over again. And that helps them avoid confusion. There's, you know, continuity and all these other kinds of things that are supposedly beneficial. So I get why they're doing it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and
I'm saying the way doesn't make sense. It's not necessarily what we want.
No, exactly, and I think and that does make it unique. I mean, while you could draw a parallel to extend the analogy, you know, I could feed my dog the science diet a little differently than someone else, or more or less, you know. I mean, I suppose it's the same kind of thing. You play this game, you know, more or less differently according to the rules, but I don't know. I do have – it spawned a question in my mind when you're talking about the RPGA games. Do those kind of compete with the what is that new thing they have out now? The
encounters.
Yeah, but the new ones, the
Lair Assault.
Lair Assault. Are those like? I don't want to say direct competition, but I mean, it's a different kind of organized play, right? They're not the same thing. They're not run by RPGA. No. So
they're often the same people that run them. Like when you go to the store, it's the same group. But they're very different. And I don't know what's going to happen to RPGA or what's going to happen to the regular like LFR compared to these other events. But it's clear where Wizards is kind of moving things. And I know which ones I'd prefer to go to.
From what I've heard, it doesn't sound like the RPGA is gonna do away with their living campaign worlds. I think the system's gonna change a little bit, but there's definitely you know, they turn it over to guys like Teos and a lot of people in the community. And I think there's so much community support still for that, that it's going to keep going. And it'll still be like an official Wizard sanctioned thing. I think they're just putting a lot of their R&D and production money into coming up with new programs as well. So.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's going away. I just think it'll continue to just be a more of a community supported event than anything. But Mike, you had said something about how. I'm already starting to brain fart on it. I waited too long for my comment. You were talking about, you know, kind of DMs getting trapped by the rules and kind of saying, you know, I ran it this way because that's what it says in the book.
Right.
And going back to that Ask a DM panel at PAX this year. You know, there was a guy who actually got up and his question was, you know, why have you guys put no role playing in fourth edition? Basically, right. Why is there no role playing in fourth edition? Yeah, why is there no role playing in fourth edition? And why is there, you know, why is it all combat? Why do I only have combat at my table?
Right. It's like, well, I don't know. Why do you only have
combat? Yeah, and they were not so. Our fault. They were so much more gracious than I was about the way they
answered. I would have been, yeah.
Question. I would have got down off the booth and probably slapped him at least once, just being like, you know.
Right.
But well, it's this idea that if they don't put rules for how to role play in and when and where exactly to put the role play into the games, then
I agree with you, but here's the problem with that. As soon as they do that, everybody will complain. They don't like the rule, or they don't like the system, or they don't. You know, it's a no win situation. Yeah, like
I am not. You know, I am not advocating.
Oh no, no, I know. I'm just agreeing with you, and I'm saying, for example, you know, this is one of those ways where WotC really gets into hot water, but when they try to get out of the hot water, the only thing around is another pot of hot water because they don't really have a choice.
Well, yeah, haters are going to hate no matter what. But the, you know, the more standardized. What's up?
Well, I was just going to say, where's the historical perspective? Because guys, if you – and this is what I would tell people that continually say, where's the role playing? It's like, okay, where was it in the first edition? The whole first chapter of the Dungeon Master's Guide was on statistics and dice rolling.
Yeah.
Well, come on. I mean, he starts it off that way.
Yeah, he gives you the bell curve for the
– I mean, yeah, for like any dice. Math. Yeah. It's like fucking algebra. And so
the more standardized we start making the game and the more rules we put in for anything, it kind of feels more like we're moving towards like a Ravenloft, a Chardalon kind of game system. Like, you know, the DM is going to roll some dice and then look on a chart and be like, okay, this is what happens next because this is exactly where the game says you have to go, you know.
Right.
The monster's going to do this because that's what it says on its card because it's close enough to you and so it has to move that way.
I do think, I mean, I think everybody would agree that 4E is certainly a very rules-heavy system and that, you know, when you weigh out the book and you weigh the amount of time spent on mechanics vice other stuff, you know, it's very heavily in favor of mechanics. And I also think that 4th edition has kind of removed a lot of power from the control of the DM, which is something I'm not crazy about as a control freak. And it's,
I actually liked it, but that's...
yeah, it's hard to... You know, for me, it's hard to get around some of that. You know, I always laugh that my first rule in the rules compendium in the new rules compendium is if the DM allows it ... You know, like every one of those is optional rule, and I can turn them all off if I want to. I think those are both criticisms that are, you know, legitimate. But then to say like, well, there's no role playing. Well, no, that's up to you and your group. You know, and a lot of it, even the mechanics are like that. I had a tweet from somebody who said, why isn't there a bonus for higher ground in 4E? You know, well, you tell me. You know, I have it in mine. You know, I have it where I'll have certain elements of terrain. When they get to that terrain, they get combat advantage against anybody else on the map. So, and it's because I want them to go have to move across the map to get up to this other place. And there's some hazard that they have to get through in order to do it, but they get a bonus for doing it. So, you know, the idea is, well, there doesn't have to be a rule in a book for everything like that. There's that, you know, the DM's best friend, right? The +2 bonus.
Right.
You can apply that anywhere.
Yeah, including role-playing situations. Someone was mentioning that on Twitter today. It's like, yeah, you know, it's and that's and that was in the first version of the Player's Handbook for 4th edition. You know, right. I mean, it continually flabbergasts me when people say no role playing in 4E. It's like, guys, come on, we've gone over this 10 billion times. So.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure that everybody has it in their mind yet that this game is theirs and that the books are secondary to them to their stuff. You know,
yeah.
That everyone says like, well, no, I need to play it the way it's in the book, and the book is a limitation and not a guide. And you know, they feel like if the book doesn't cover it, then it doesn't exist. When it's like, no, your game is your own, and
yeah,
you know, the books are guidelines, and you can use them or not use them as you see fit. And I don't know if that hits a lot of people. Like, they're not, I don't know if it, maybe they're not willing to take that responsibility. They don't want that responsibility.
Yeah.
No, I don't know.
There is a danger in the fact that, and I've seen this, is that the rules do describe so much that you wonder then, do I need to find a rule for this if I do it? Or, yeah, or do I have time to go and find a rule to see if this has been talked about yet? Or do I need to make it up my own? Now, with the old editions of the rules, I can say that, you know, most of the time, I mean, this is all before all the splat books and stuff like that came out, and for second and third editions and stuff. But when you're talking about the first edition of the game, you're going, well, it's more than likely this hasn't been thought of yet, so I'm going to make up my own set of rules. No big deal.
Right.
And the DM was expected to do that. You know, Gary says over and over again, hey, if it's not in here, make it up, right?
Make it up,
so,
right.
And
see, this is where,
and that's not said again as often, I think. I mean, I does say it in some places in the fourth edition as well, but you wonder, as much material has been published, you go, should I find a rule for this, or do I really have to make it up? And it's right. Like, if I have to make it up, how much effort is that going to be with how restricted the rules are? So,
yeah, or am I
going to
break everything else?
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying
to get at. That's where you have the handy little house rule that I use, which is if you don't know the rule offhand at the table, the DM makes a ruling. You go with that. You play it through. After that session is over, feel free to go look up the rule, see if you can find something. And when you get that rule, then you talk about it at the beginning of the following session, and you say, we're not going to retcon. What we're going to do is go over this rule and say, okay, here is the way that we're playing this from now on. But the ruling that I made offhand before in the other session still stands.
Right.
And that you just run it that way, and you let that be an expectation of the group that that's how it's going to be. That you're not, you know, if you can't figure something out within 20 seconds, you're not going to call a break and go grab 5 books and try to look up the rule for that thing, or pull out your computer, turn it on, and go to the compendium and see what it says. You just make the ruling and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that, as Randall said, in the first edition, that was really expected because a lot of things just weren't written down. Whereas in every later edition, more and more and more and more and more gets written down. And so then you wonder, well, where was that rule again? You know, where's the rule for aquatic combat in 4th edition? Well, it's in the monster manual. You know, it's not in the rule books. It's not in the PHB or the DMG. It's in the monster manual. Okay, well, now can you remember that? Or, you know, do you look it up later? You know what I mean? So it's that sort of thing where See, whereas before you used to assume it's not written down, there's just no ruling, or maybe it was in a Dragon magazine and you just missed that article or whatever, so you make it up as you go. In 4th edition, you assume it's written down, so the assumption has completely flipped over. You mm-hmm. assume it's written down somewhere, you just don't know where to find it right now.
Yeah, and that's great for rules on the fly. My bigger concern is, particularly in Paragon and Epic tier, and of course Mike's really familiar with this, is that not everything is... You worry about, and this is in campaign design, not on the rules, not on the fly stuff, not in necessarily in encounter design, but in campaign design, am I going to come up with some kind of system that's going to break something else? In other words, if I come up with a system of how characters can earn strongholds or something like that, am I going to break something down the line if I allow them to do that? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the kind of thing that concerns me more than actual in-play stuff. You know, it's campaign design things that, because I think we can all agree that as you get higher in tier, Paragon and Epic, the nature of the game's got to change. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's not fun anymore because there's just so much to do. So, I mean, that's, you know, as far as I'm concerned anyway.
By the way, I apologize for the dog.
Oh, quite all right.
It's all right. As long as your dog's not snoring in the background.
Hey, now.
Kind of wish he was.
Oh.
Yeah, we miss that dog.
So, Randall, the solution to that is that you develop your system however you want to do it with strongholds and whatnot, and then if you really want to know if it's going to break something, you play with it.
Yeah, you play test it. And I think you're right about that.
You have to play. And then when you're playing it and you realize it's broken, then is when the whole making a rule off the cuff comes in. And, you know, I mean, so if you start at first level and you get all the way to Epic or Paragon and you're messing around with stuff like that, hopefully your group has been together long enough that they trust you to make a fair ruling, whatever it is. Even if you temporarily rule against something that is actually a written rule that people know because you don't want to break the game during that session, you know, you have to have some trust. Your players have to have some trust in you to be able to do that.
Yep, I think you're right. Yeah.
All right, next topic.
So I have
that silence. So that's it.
Let me throw my topics, and you guys can choose if any of these are interesting. D&D Larisalt and Wizards focus on material for the friendly local game shop, and what that means, and you know, pros and cons of that. Mordinikin's Emporium, and specifically, how do you handle loot in your game? And my favorite topic, which I'm spending a fair bit of time thinking about and probably going to write a whole bunch of stuff about, is how to be a lazy dungeon master. How to be a better lazy dungeon master.
Which is ironic considering you said that you were a control freak.
I know, and that I'm working really hard to be a lazy DM.
Oh, okay. That's my personal favorite. Oh, okay.
Nobody got that joke.
So
I can't really talk about Larisalt because I don't play organized play and I'm not real familiar with it. So
yeah, I don't.
I'm not even sure what the actual question is in that topic.
Veto.
Well, is it? It's not a question. It's just a topic, something to discuss. Oh. I mean,
well, he seemed like he had sort of a comparison. Well,
my thought is I think there's a lot of attention going to the FLGS. There's a lot of material that's going that way that isn't available anywhere else. And,
I see.
My big question is like, well, why is that? Is it, you know, I don't think it's that interesting a topic, frankly.
Yeah. I mean, we all have answers for it. So,
vetoing that topic.
Well, you go ahead and veto that topic. I'm glad you let us on your podcast today.
Hey, Thaddeus, you know, I'm hosting the call. I can just bump mic off.
Oh, yeah.
Just give me the word, you know.
What are some of the other topics again? I'm actually working on updating the website right now.
Mordinikin's Emporium, right?
I do. Mordinkind's is right.
Mordinkind's? I can't pronounce Morden, it.
I have to Google Mordinkainen.
I've heard it pronounced so many different ways.
Is it cool?
Morty's.
It is really cool. Now, understand that, like, I actually got a little bit of enjoyment out of the original Adventures Vaults, and not many other people did. I actually have a good time. I get out a lot of books every once in a while and just thumb through them for ideas and stuff like that. And I got a lot of ideas out of some of the material in the Adventures Vault. And this book is just amazing. I mean, has anyone else seen it yet?
No.
Oh, man. Okay. So first of all, they added a couple new, like, they added a new armor type, unless it slipped past me in another published book. So these, like, they have properties for armor now, like durable, tough, barbed. Has that hasn't been released in anything else yet, right?
I don't think
I'm not slipping in my old age.
Not in fourth edition. In 3.5, they did have some augments that you could get for your armor, like putting spikes on them and whatnot that would do.
Right. Well, these are new armor types. So, like, split mail is durable 3, which means the first time in an encounter, you subtract 3 damage the first time you get hit.
Oh.
And then you actually, when you have magic armor, you actually add the bonus to that. And it's got barbed, which means, you know, the enemy takes damage the first time someone attacks you. There's full plate now and spiked plate. And yeah, so they went and added kind of more armor options. And then
it's still,
you know,
light, heavy, and medium. There's still the same classes of armor, right?
Right.
Okay, so that hasn't changed.
No.
Because otherwise you're adding bells and whistles.
So nope, just light and heavy. Just new new properties.
All right.
You know, and then you've got your regular complement of, like, magical weapons and armor and gear. Except for these seem to be more geared towards Essentials players. I guess it just follows more in the Essentials design philosophy that we've seen through a lot of their products recently. You know, like, common items are items that really just give you minor bonuses to things. You know, like the Lesser Badge of Berserker gives you a +4 to AC versus opportunity attacks. So you can go charging with it, but it's not like the original Badge of Berserker where you don't provoke opportunity attacks at all, and you could just go charging across the battlefield all you wanted. So, and they've done a pretty good job of taking and making anything that is really going to change the way your character operates and make it a rare. And, you know, it talks about how to use those, the item availability rules and how they're ranked. And, you know, rare items come along maybe once a tier. And uncommon items, you know, you get maybe one or two of those also. And then common items you can just buy at most stores. And so that's nice. It's nice that they kind of laid that out in books. And so now DMs will have it to kind of point to players. But what really got me excited is, A, there's cursed items in here, and they've kind of released rules on how to – yeah. And the book goes into some flavor about how to create magic items and how to, you know, put your own stuff into your games.
That will be nice.
And then there is story items, which – let me go to the page here. This is fun podcasting when you get to hear me flipping pages.
It goes right along with the traffic outside your window.
Yeah. I live on a busy street. If you want to hear me, you got to hear the traffic. That's the sad part. Everybody's like, yeah, I don't want to hear the traffic.
The window doesn't shut.
Yeah. The window is shut, man.
Oh, it is. Wow.
Yeah.
Dude.
No, this is what I have to listen to every day. So welcome to living in the middle of downtown. No, but these story items are things like, let me find a good one for you. Like a curse carrier. So it says, like, an evil wizard or warlock either used an item to place a curse on one of the characters or place a curse on an item, which is delivered to a character. The curse grows within the character. It brings on many harmful and horrible effects and eventually causes death or some other terrible effect. The curse cannot be removed by normal means, blah, 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 blah. And so it's just these different items that are like, these aren't magic items that are going to give you a bonus. These are items that have some kind of effect attached to them that you can use. I mean, they're almost just like story hooks or, you know, little plot changes or plot devices that you can use that are like little enchanted items. And the great thing about it is it really, the first half of it, of the story items section, is just about how you design a story item. And the rest is just like, here are a few that we've designed, but really you should make your own. Hmm. So,
does it give advice about how to distribute loot in your game? And the other long shot, does it have any random loot tables?
There's no random loot table that I've found so far, but I mean, it does give you a little bit of information about ways that DMs can distribute loot, but it doesn't really go into, I mean, amazingly great detail about it. It just talks about...
Does the Essentials book have that, though?
A little bit. The Essentials book kind of hints to the rarity rules that were supposed to come out in this book. And the rarity rules aren't exactly like a rule set. It just talks about, you know, like rare, like I said earlier, rare items. You know, you only usually get about one per tier. Uncommon items, you get maybe two or three. And then common items, you know, if you have a backpack full of magical gear, it should all be common items, you know? Mm-hmm. So,
can you still melt them down for residuum?
You can, and it talks about how to sell, too. It talks about the fact that there's kind of a price tiering, rare items, if you can actually find somebody who would have enough money to buy it, rare items usually get full price, and then, you know, a smaller percentage for uncommon, and then common items are, you know, at that 1/4 rule. There's also
So you get more money from uncommons?
No, uncommons you get like 1/4 of the original cost. Gotcha. Rare items you should get full price.
Oh, really?
So yeah, and then Yeah, so rare, full price, uncommons, you get like 75% or something like that, and then, okay. The amount you can sell it for scales with the type of rarity it is. There's also stuff about hirelings and how to kind of make little hirelings, and it's got a whole little.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's got a bunch of already kind of pre-made traits and stuff like that you can add to your hirelings, and then how much they're worth by level, and then some sample henchmen towards the back, and it's also got an.
Oh, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was going to say it's got a.
Yeah. I'll let you finish that.
I was just going to say the last thing is it's actually got a really nice section on mundane just adventuring gear, which I love, and Randall knows I'm about to start a column, like a series on the website about how to get more mileage out of mundane items, so that way, you know, you can start treating mundane items like treasure if you can actually get your players to start using them instead of relying on, you know, everything magical.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can ask all the questions you want, because that's the last thing I had to say about it.
So how do you
quick sample stat blocks. Sample stat blocks for hirelings. Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. Thank you. Okay.
How do you guys actually distribute loot in your games? How do you decide what loot is available? Do you let them choose, particularly with uncommon and rare?
Oh, I don't give loot.
At all.
I'm super duper stingy. What I started doing more recently is I ask the players to give me like three items that they think that their PC would find useful or that they could tailor to make their PC be something special. Mm-hmm. And then I might give them one of those every 5 levels.
Mm-hmm.
But I play a really not low magic in the sense of there's no magic users or warlock powers or anything like that, but low magic in terms of, you know, magic items are special. So since they're special, they don't come along very often. Some things are relatively more common, like potions and whatnot, potions of healing, but so they're still not as common as like the book would tell you.
Are you guys ready for this? So yeah. it actually gives a little stat description for 10-foot pole.
Nice.
Prodding dangerous looking things with the 10-foot pole lets you trigger many traps from the safety of 2 squares away.
Nice.
Giggity. I gotta say, I love.
Talk about where they carry it.
Yeah, yeah. I think they break down. I think everybody needs a bag of holding or something for a 10-foot pole. No, I love mundane items. I feel like I should be giving them out a lot more than magic items. And as far as loot goes, I honestly do the wish list with my players. And I know for a lot of DMs hate the wish list. But I don't always, and I think Sam said this once at the DMs roundtable at Gen Con, I don't always go off the wish list. I just kind of know what they're looking for. And that means, because, you know, if it's cooperative storytelling, then it's about meeting them halfway in the middle. Like, I'm not going to give them every awesome magical item they ever wanted. But I know that, you know, I can throw them all a couple things that they want and then a couple things that they don't want, and see if they can put them to good use, and then everybody's happy, because then I've thrown out a couple randoms and then they all have a couple things that they know they like. So it's like Christmas and not getting one thing you asked for, right? I'm sure everybody loves Christmas, you know, getting presents, and even if you didn't get anything you asked for, you'd still be like, okay, well, yeah, I still got some cool stuff. But you're gonna walk away thinking, oh man, you know, no one paid one bit of attention to the stuff I actually wanted. And so, yeah, you know, I got to give a little bit of it to my players.
What I've done in the past when I've decided to be relatively evil was I sort of get a wish list from them, but then I give them completely random. Well, it seems to them to be random. To me, it's not random. I give them these odd items. But the key is that they could use those items to gain access to the other items that they really wanted. If they used those items in interesting ways, or if they used it to help them solve a puzzle, or, you know, there's various different ways to do that. And then they'll suddenly find, you know, they'll come upon the other item that they actually wanted. And then they end up with two items. Mm-hmm. But if they sort of, you know, a lot of times a player, you know, you do get excited, right? And they go, oh, cool, an item. And then they sort of realize it's not what they wanted and they can't really see an immediate use for it. And they get really bummed out. But then they ignore that item. It's like, you know, I want to see you role play with that item. You know, if you were really a fighter and you found this thing and it was magic and you didn't previously have a magic weapon, you're going to be excited as crap about that thing, whether it was the thing that your meta player person wanted or not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So let me see you role play with that. Let me see you, you know, do something with that. And then you'll get rewarded with, you know, the item that maybe is closer to what you actually wanted.
You know, and that takes me back to a fun anecdotal story that was at one point I was DMing for a group and they were about fourth level and I had given them an item that was like ninth level. And I was like, okay, these guys are going to love this because this is, you know, this is outside their league. But it wasn't like a weapon, you know, it wasn't like a +2 weapon or +2 armor or anything like that. I think it was like gloves of Storin or something like that, you know, and you can put one 10-pound item in each glove, which is pretty awesome when you think about it roleplay-wise, but it wasn't anything that anyone in the group was looking for, mm-hmm. and they eventually ended up just throwing it away.
Yeah, that's sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they traded it away to an NPC for a service because they didn't want to spend gold on it. And I was just like, dude, you guys are fourth-level characters walking around with a ninth-level item, and you're just like, ah, no, here, we're going to – and so it's just like, ah, oh, you know, this is what happens when you give them stuff that – isn't what they're looking for. You always run that risk of them just, you know.
I had not to talk about my game, but I had a
I love it when you say that, because you say that like every episode.
What was the it was the one that was set in the Shadowfell and there's like a huge keep that they had to deal with. Oh damn it,
keep on the Shadowfell.
No, it's a Paragon level, so they had to, what was it called? Nightworm Fortress. Oh, I've got my reference here. So,
Why don't you put her on?
Yeah, she you can tell the story better than I can. But they got a magic carpet. I think it was random loot, and they got a magic carpet, and none of them could figure out what they wanted to do with the magic carpet. So they sold it to like this Shardarkai witch. And they're like, yeah, 1/5 gold is fine. It's just so funny. And for the whole rest of the campaign, the witch is flying around them like, yeah!
Awesome, and they're like, yeah, it sucks.
And they go to the Nightmare Fortress. It's this huge fortress that's way up in the sky. They're like, boy,
I was gonna say, then you put them in a situation where they desperately need to fly, and the witch flies by.
The flying carpet. And they're like, no, it's not a plus bonus to my attack roll. What do I care? So I thought that was pretty funny.
That's what I mean, though, is giving them an item that you know is going to be useful in at least one major sort of encounter, right. not even necessarily a combat, but definitely in some sort of encounter, some sort of use that they will have for it. And if they, you know, if they sell it for 1/5 the value of that item, it's sort of like, I don't know, would you do that? And like, would your character really do that? Would your PC really do that? And not that, you know, not that I'm not one of those DMs that says, oh, you know, the players have to speak only in character and anything you say is what the character has said, and or, you know, that everything that you say at the table or everything you do, even if you're joking and it's obvious, that means that you did it. Or I mean, that's fine if somebody wants to play that way, but that's not the way I run my table. And, you know, but there has to be a little bit of verisimilitude, right? There has to be a little bit of, well, your fighter who is now third level and who does not have any sort of magical item at all suddenly has these, you know, gloves of grasping or whatever Thaddeus was talking about. And it's like, your PC would think that is the coolest shit in the world.
Right.
For at least 10 minutes. You wouldn't just go to the nearest store and sell them.
I'd get rid of this thing.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to need those. Forget it, you know.
Well, the worst part is it.
You know what I blame for that, guys? MMOs.
Oh,
I blame
that
on MMOs full out. Because the way I work magic items in my campaign is that they're pretty much random. If they're in a place that's sophisticated enough and they can buy common magic items, I allow them to pick commons or uncommons. Well, at this point, uncommons. I haven't gotten more than Kanan's book yet. But if they have the gold, then I will generally allow them to get something that they've had their eye on. But they got to have the gold, But the thing is that I give out my stuff at random. I challenge my players to identify with the stories and things that occurred while they found that item. And so that those things become a part of that character. If you find a special sword or a magical ring or something like that as part of an adventure, then even if you don't have an immediate combat use for it, it's going to be useful in some way to the party. And usually what happens is that these random magic items they find, the party gets together and decides who best can use this. Mm-hmm. And then it'll go to that person. And if that person has that slot filled, there'll either be a trade-off or someone else will get it instead. Right. And so I challenge my players. It's like, look, kind of like what Sam was saying. It's like, your characters found this pretty rare item, and these aren't everywhere. Sure, can you sell it? Yeah, I'll probably allow you to sell it. But you're missing out if you do. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how I've always approached it. I've tried to not put in magic items that have to be carried in order to complete the story. I've never done that.
No, it's not. No, that's a great point to bring up. It's not that they have to have it in order to complete the story. It's that if they have that and they can use it in an interesting way when the opportunity presents itself and they've really thought about it and decided to actually embrace that item and try to find a use for it, they will get access to something that they would not otherwise have access to. It's not that not using it stops them from you know, completing a story or something. That's why I brought up the wish list thing. You know, let's say they want a sword and instead they get these glove things. Well, maybe these glove things, you know, help them solve a puzzle. And when they solve that puzzle, you know, a secret door open. This is the most generic example ever, right? But a secret door opens and behind that chamber is the actual sword.
Right.
You know, whereas if they didn't have those gloves because they went and sold them, when they went through that room, there's really no way for them to use those gloves to open that door. So they just don't have access to that item. But it doesn't stop them from completing their quest or you know, gaining other cool stuff. It just – they missed out on an opportunity. And that's why I said that's also something I do when I want to be relatively evil, because I try not to punish players for, you know, for things like that. But every once in a while, it's sort of like, you know, players in my Monday night game, they like to whine that I don't give them magic items. So I finally got tired of them whining. So I gave them some items and they seemed to them to be relatively random. And if they had cared about those items and done something interesting or cool with those items, they would have gotten access to a lot more. But they just groused about how I never gave them items. And then all of a sudden when I gave them items or when I presented items to their characters, they just weren't things that they wanted to use. Yeah. So, well, you know, beggars can't be choosers.
Right.
So I've been doing something interesting in my Gloomrot. And I don't think it's anything totally, you know, I mean, it's not unique. I think other people have done this before. But in my Gloomrot adventure, they have access to all of the common magical items that they want for the regular cost. So that way they can keep their base stats up and, you know, they can get a little bit of interesting things. And then uncommon and rares are randomly determined. I actually built an Excel spreadsheet and I use random.org to generate a random number and tell me what gear, you know, is available. And I keep like three random ones on hand for random loot, because I use the random loot tables from the Dungeon Master Kit or the Rules Compendium when they defeat encounters. But then the local stores also have some random uncommons and rares available that are only available then. So they'll go to the store and there'll be three random uncommon or rares that they can choose from. And they can just pass on them and say, no, we're not interested. Or if they're like, wow, it's really good, but it's four levels higher than we are and it's really expensive. And, you know, we're going to have to pool all of our money together in order to buy this one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, then they can choose to do that. And
when they leave and go back, are those three items still there?
No, it's gone.
Okay.
They're gone and they get another set of random items changed every day.
They can't go on a quest to gain that 10 grand and then.
No, I mean, if there's something that kind of fits the story and if they want to actually go on a particular quest or actually find that thing, if they were that interested in it, there'd probably be a way for them to kind of hunt down the item. Maybe they have to now find the guy who bought it and, you know, get it from them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, good deal.
But one of the things I'm going to do, I'm doing a lot of like unlocking in this game. So instead of just having items and experiences rewards, they get rewarded with character themes they get rewarded with in this one they pick one race, but they can actually change their class if they choose. So they can unlock additional classes that they can then switch to as a, you know, once per day they can switch to a different class. And one of the other things they're going to do is, you know, depending on who they work with in Gloomrot, they might open up better access to a store with a wider variety of stuff, which would be Mordenkainen or Morden Ganon's.
Just say it how you say it, man. Don't sweat it.
So that way, like, you know, they might get a choice of five items instead of three. But I built all that kind of around the game Borderlands, which had a really good random loot system in it. And keeping this Excel spreadsheet has really helped a lot. What I like about it too is I keep, you know, all of the items that level up, they get, you know, they get just that level. But any of the, there's some items that are useful at any level, you know, boots that are level three but would be useful up until you're a paragon, those stay in the list. So they still have access to some lower level uncommon and rares that are pretty cheap if they happen to come up in the roll. So that seems to work pretty well. And I think that what I'm hoping will happen is they'll get some weird items and go like, you know, I wasn't planning on playing a mage, but we got these like three really cool wands. So maybe I'm going to figure out how to unlock the mage class and I'll play a mage. Or they'll just say, you know, wow, I never thought that this sword would be any good, but I've managed to find a way or a reason why this sword is actually pretty good. So we'll see how that works out. But so far, I like it. My last campaign was Dark Sun, and they just basically got nothing. You know, they got a couple of items here and there, but it was really rough.
That's kind of supposed to be the point, though, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the point. I really like the alternate advancement system. You know, I mean, it meant that you just didn't have to worry about making sure their gear is up to date. Pick up a jawbone, and it's a +4 jawbone. I killed the conversation.
No, that's okay. That was a good way to end on. You said you only didn't have much time, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'll take off another 5 minutes or so.
Well, aside from a copy of Mordenkainen's, I also got Gradmore Abbey.
Oh, how was that?
Nice.
It's pretty nice.
I really want that. That's my next. Now, that's my next mini campaign.
Now it came with two treasure cards, which is what I wanted to talk about. Hold on. Give me 2 seconds. I'm gonna go run and grab them. I'll be right back. Hold on.
Oh, we can do
No, you know it's got to be the girl from Ipanema, dude.
If you're not there, go buy it.
We are sad. Okay. Sad.
Yeah, we're pretty low rent here at the DM
Round.
So
well, whatever.
You don't get real musical input. You get people humming over the mic.
Not right. People. Not people. You get Randall and Sam.
Oh, that's right.
We're just the more musically inclined or cursed
or prone to break.
Disinclined. Yeah. We're prone to make asses of ourselves.
That's right. As evidenced by free stuff from other dudes.
That's right. I'm just going to randomly throw that theme song into the podcast every once in a while.
And I also had I wanted to talk about that as well, but hold on. So it came with these two random cards that are – they just say treasure card on the back, and then it's got actually two items. But
is it actually random, or is it that each box has the same two cards?
I think they're part of the game, aren't they? I think they're in the adventure.
Are they? I haven't read.
So they're not actually random. Then they go with.
No, they're actually designed for you to hand out during the adventure.
Cool.
I thought.
Well, the worst part is I can't even find them now. So.
Yeah, they're lost.
They're gone. They are gone.
So they don't come with the box. Just to ignore Thaddeus.
It also has the deck of many things, though, right?
That's right.
Yes, it does.
You didn't lose did you?
Oh, I found them. I just kind of wondered if maybe they weren't planning on using this format again with like an upcoming product. Because, it just says Dungeons & Dragons treasure card, and it's the Moonbane, which is a level 10 rare sword, and the Torque of Justice, which is a level 10 rare headpiece, I guess. Or neck piece. Oh, it's a neck piece. And, I'm sure there's
wondrous...
some kind of plot.
Yeah, are they like wondrous items that you need or that you come across if you finish a certain portion of the
campaign? I'm sure they are, but it just seems odd to come up with a whole format for a treasure card for just two cards, and then mm-hmm. that's it.
So you're speculating that another product is coming down the line.
I am guessing that there may be another product coming down the line.
It could be that they want to get feedback on them to see if people would think that it would be worthwhile to include those in future products. It might not be that there's anything on the calendar right now.
Those are in the red box.
The treasure card is in the red box?
There are treasure cards in the red box.
Not many, I don't think.
No, but there are some. They're low-level cards. But there are some treasure cards in the red box, I think.
I remember, I think it was Randall who had speculated that Mordenkainen's was coming back as
treasure cards. I would think that would have been pretty cool, actually. But,
but
I'm okay with the book.
Seeing these treasure cards, I think.
Well, treasure cards would be a lot more useful than the power cards that they came with. Remember the power cards that they tried to sell?
Yeah, those are useless.
Yeah. They don't have any of the actual information on it. Right. No one's going to go write it on the card.
Right. No one's going to give you the bonuses that you need. But the treasure cards, as a DM, I would totally use those to hand them out.
Yeah.
You know, if I could say, like, okay, there's random gear. Here, draw three cards. That's perfect.
Well, I've been doing that in my campaigns. I make them myself. So, I've been doing that since the beginning.
And that is...
I do that too.
Why I brought these cards up, because I would buy them. I've never been a huge proponent of the here's more cards to buy, spend more money, but I think if they could do it in a way where you could actually buy it.
Fortune cards.
Mm-hmm. If they could do it in a way you could buy a deck, and maybe they could have boosters, but you could get everything that's been published in Mordenkainen's you could get in one deck, and then future cards would come out in little boosters, that would be awesome.
That's something that they sort of do for the Paizo Adventure Paths. They have item cards, but the cards don't have stats on them. So they're meant as a sort of a visual representation and more of a nice stylistic addition rather than a rules thing. So it's sort of what Paizo has done and sort of one step further. I like the idea. I think it's a good idea. I buy a lot of those item card kind of things because I like to be able to say, okay, instead of necessarily having to write down that you found, three gems and 30 gold pieces and two daggers and one of them has, some sort of symbol on it, I just hand the players the cards and they distribute them amongst themselves and whoever has the card is the PC that's holding that item.
That's what I do now, except for coins. I mint my own coins, and I make the characters divide up the money.
You mint your own coins. Can you send some dollars my way?
Yeah, I wish they were real. They're made out of plastic and paint, but yeah. and ink stamps, so. But yeah, I found metallic paint for copper, silver, mm-hmm. gold, and platinum, and... And I have a couple of blog posts based on what I did with that.
Yeah, I saw those.
Yeah, so it drives my characters crazy, but it is fun, like having them open up a little chest, and mm-hmm. you got all this coinage in there, and then they got to sort through it and figure out how it's going to be split up, and then they can go to the bank. See, and when they go to the bank tanks 10%. On all exchanges, so
yeah. Well, see, what I like is handing them a bunch of item cards, and let's say one of them's a dagger, and they it's a dagger, and then they have to figure out, okay, does it have a magical properties? Does it actually look like this? Whose character does it look like it would suit better? And how do they find out if it's magical or if it has any other properties? And, because I don't just do the thing where I hand it to them and say, oh, you found a +2 vicious dagger. I actually make them work for the... I'm mean,
so
right?
Cool.
I rarely give them something, and then when I do, I make them work to figure out what it actually is.
Yeah. And this
hey
is
guys,
why
I gotta take off. Let me just jump in real quick here and say goodbye.
Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you again for having us.
Should we upgrade to a new guest, or should we? I mean, trade to a new guest.
No, I have to leave in a few minutes too. So,
all right.
I'm not sure it's worth adding a new person in.
Well, damn.
Talk to you guys later.
Take it easy, Mike.
Bye.
Later, Mike.
People aren't going to know what to do when we don't hit the 2 hour mark. Actually, since Mike's leaving,
we've got two episodes in the can that are less than 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two? I thought you only had one in the can.
No, we've got one from last week that I will release tomorrow, and then we've got one from June 21st that never got. It was a lost episode, and I found it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I have no idea what we talked about, but I'm going to name it the lost episode. And 1 week when we don't have anything to release, I'll throw it up there and say, hey, blast from the past.
Yeah, that's right. That'll be awesome.
Of course, now it won't be a surprise because this is being recorded.
Well, let's just end it now.
Okay.
And then call this a show since Mike left, and we're at an hour. So an hour's good. So we'll stop recording and then we can discuss.
Cool. All right. Well, everybody say goodbye, and then I'll say goodbye and I'll edit that thing about June 21st out.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on the DM Roundtable.
Thank you for joining us. Oh, wait, hold on. We got to get
said that.
Thank you for joining us on the Tome Show.
This has been the DM Roundtable.
Wait, what is that? Are we like sitting by a fire?
Yes, that's crackling fire. Yes. We're in smoking jackets.
Oh, very nice.
Yes. We are totally doing the next DM Roundtable live.
That's right. We're in smoking jackets.
That's right. We're going to have Barca Loungers brought in.
Yes. And and Courvoisier.
Oh, man.
Whoa. What is that? You're now talking big fancy Eastern words. What does that mean?
Let's stick with the
Courvoisier?
Scotch.
It's a drink.
Cognac.
Yeah. We can.
It's terrible cognac.
It is really bad.
Unless you get like the XO, which is just insanely ridiculously expensive and still not that great.
But say goodbye.
I already did. Bye. Thanks for listening to the Tome Show, guys.
Hey, you don't need to be plugging another podcast on this one.
I'm just saying, they probably turned us off like 20 minutes ago and switched over to the Tome Show. So
we'll
probably
see you next week on Hee Haw.
Okay, and on I'm
sorry. I was gonna say laughing.
Yeah,
you bet your sweet bippy.
Suck it to me.
Suck it.